quiet, fast. First of all, what did you do with my house? I came back, and it's gone. For those of you who haven't met me yet, my name's Dan. I apologize for stuff I'm about to say at the beginning. But it is so good to be back with you. So good to be back with you. I am grateful that our church family allows me from time to time to be away in a dual role. I function as a chaplain in the Air Force. And so thank you for your prayer and support in my time away. I'll just kind of give you a little snapshot of the last couple weeks for me. It's very, very spiritually heavy month of August for me in my role as a chaplain, working through some really deep and kind of some dark heart issues with a lot of the folks that I've been interacting with. But I'm grateful for your prayer and support while I'm there. I just get so many opportunities to share the love of Jesus with a lot of folks who really have nowhere else to turn. And so part of your support helps us stay engaged as a gospel presence in that space. So thank you for your support in that. All right, if this is your first time here, a couple things just to help you get oriented. You can take out your phone and you can scan that QR code that's on the seat back right in front of you. That's gonna take you to lpguest.com. You'll find a welcome card. You'll also find the Notes app. If you open up the Worthington Notes app, there's an opportunity for you to follow along, take notes on some of the things we're talking about today. There's even a special spot for you to post questions. And I think that this series is almost designed to provoke questions. Like, there will be things that come up as we continue in this series that are going to make you say, hey, I don't know about that, or even lean in and kind of push back on that. Part of my, like, desire in preaching and how I like to teach is really to raise a lot of questions for us, and we won't be able to answer all of them. So if there's one that sticks out to you, write it down, send it in via the Notes app, and we'll follow up this week and have a larger conversation about this. So I want us to think and for the scriptures to engage our imaginations. Right, so that's part of why we have that opportunity for you. Okay, if you have a Bible with you, why don't you meet me in the Old Testament book of Job? The Old Testament book of Job. No shame in turning to the table of contents. If you have a real Bible with you, you can find it there, the book of Job. If you're in the Psalms, you're a little bit too far, just go left a little bit. A book of Job. Last week, we started a new series called The Good Life, looking at what is typically a really challenging book for many of us to make sense of and understand. And Job is challenging for a couple of reasons, right? Like, if you've not read any of it before, that's okay. All right, you'll pick up on this today. A good chunk of this is written as poetry. And it can almost feel sometimes like you're reading through old Shakespearean English. It's kind of hard to put together sometimes. How many of you like to sit back and relax by reading poetry? Right, exactly. Nobody. Nobody, okay? That's why Job is hard. It's just hard to follow what it's even talking about. But more than that, right, I think that this is a challenging book for us to make sense of because of the topic and even how the topic is addressed in Job. There's a whole book about suffering. And you almost can automatically feel that, like, incongruence. Like, we just sang here, like, that the goodness of God is going to follow us all the days of our lives. What do we do with seasons of life where it really doesn't feel like that's happening? Like, is this whole thing a sham? What do we do with that? I think the book of Job invites us to rethink a few things. And that's part of the reason why it's challenging. It's you sit down to read this. Most of the book, with a surface level reading of the book, is kind of depressing. Like, Job tends not to be the part of the Bible that, like, if your friend's going through something, you're like, oh, let me go to Job and find an encouraging passage to share with them. Like, you're not finding Job on any Christian t-shirts. There's no mugs that have, like, Job verses, or you're not sharing it on Instagram, things like that. Like, that's not the book of Job. It doesn't really find that stuff there. More than that, depending on how you understand and read this story, the book actually becomes problematic when you really start to think about what it says, right? I mean, Job, the main character, he suffers terribly in this book. He loses everything, including his kids. all he wants from God is the most natural thing in the world that anyone else would want in a season of suffering. He just wants an answer as to why he's going through any of this stuff to begin with. He never gets that answer. And it really sounds like God is actually annoyed with his questions when you get to the end of the book. And the way this whole thing wraps up, there's like a nice little bow on the end of Job's story, but almost in a way that feels like it kind of cheapens everything he just went through. I mean, having lost everything, including his kids. And while he gets like his property and, you know, animals and relationships back and it gets even more kids, he doesn't get the ones that he lost back. And so I think more often than not, like if we're honest reading this book, we're kind of left not really knowing what to do with it. I mean, other than, you know, it's in the Bible, so it's probably important. Might come up on my annual read through the Bible plan, but I'll kind of rush through it and kind of make it through the book of Job. But what if there's something we've missed about this book? What if in trying to make sense of all the little poetic dialogues that move through the book, what if we end up missing the forest for the trees and we end up largely writing off a book that when we really see it for what it is so much more than like Eeyore's diary, but actually this rich and surprisingly refreshing model for us as we walk through our own seasons of pain, depression, hardship, and suffering. This is why I actually think it's helpful to preach through this book as like a flyover, like we're doing. We're spending 5 weeks in Job. And it's not so that we can avoid like some of the bigger problems that I just talked about. It's so that we can take a step back and look at the whole thing, to see it as a masterpiece for what it is. But from that perspective of seeing the whole story, that we would walk away with something to actually hold on to as we move through the rest of this life, knowing that just like Job, each and every one of us will encounter days, months, and maybe even years when we feel broke down, abandoned, left for dead, for no discernibly good reason at all. You know, the more I've read through this ancient story, and it is an ancient story, the more I've started to find Job to be a really familiar traveling companion. And though this book may not offer us the answers that we want or are initially looking for, the book of Job actually helps us to make sense of God and ourselves in our own darkest moments. So here's how I want to spend our time through the rest of this series. I want to spend our time, looking at how the book of Job offers a series of invitations to us. Each week is a single invitation. Now, all of them are invitations to rethink or reimagine some aspect of God or ourselves. Maybe it's something we think we already know, but need to have that reimagined. We're going to see that Job, as a book, it invites us to reimagine God's economy or how he works in the world. That's today. To reimagine God's economy. Next week, we're going to see that Job invites us to honestly face what we'll call the dark night of the soul. Week 3, Job invites us to rethink our need for answers and our addiction to certainty. And the final week, we're going to see that Job invites us to reimagine God's endgame. Like, where's he going with all of this? And I know that sounds like a little ethereal, maybe the last couple of weeks having different preachers here who are fully tethered to reality is helpful, but I promise we're going to get to some concrete stuff here. But at the end of the series, my genuine hope is that Job becomes for all of us that familiar friend as we navigate some of the most challenging, painful, lonely, and dark seasons of life. So to that end, let me pray, and we'll get started. Father, we pause this morning and we ask that you would speak to us. Go through, sometimes it feels like this pomp and circumstance of being here on a Sunday morning, but I pray that you would allow us to calmly sit and hear from you. That you'd give us ears to hear your voice through your word. Father, that you would remind us and help us to reimagine what you are like, especially if we're coming in here ragged because of what the last season has been for us. Some of us are here today. We have very real unanswered questions for you. And so like Job, we want to call you to account. And it's not coming from a place of, God, you owe me something else, or you need to be better to me. It's coming from a real place of hurt. We pray that your voice would be like a healing balm to our souls today. Bring us refreshment, rejuvenation. We trust you to do that work. And we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, let's go ahead and get started here. Real quick, in case you missed last week, let me give you a quick summary of what the book of Job is all about. First of all, Job as a book is part of what we call the wisdom literature in the Old Testament, along with books like Proverbs, Psalms, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. And as a whole, when the Bible talks about wisdom, and when we're talking about wisdom, here's what we mean. This is a definition behind me. Wisdom is rightly understanding how God has ordered the world and aligning our lives in trustful obedience to him. Okay? In other words, the underlying point of all of the wisdom books in the Old Testament, the ones we just talked about, is to help us understand more of what God is like and how we then ought to operate in his world. That's what wisdom looks like. Second thing to keep in mind, this book, while it is biographical, is not a biography of Job. It's not a biography of some guy named Job. It's a story that has been thoughtfully and intentionally arranged with intricate and poetic speeches carrying us all the way through most of the book. Now, I'm not saying there wasn't a real person named Job who actually experienced tremendous suffering, but I think that remembering this is poetry will help us make even more personal connections to what's being talked about here, even when our own stories don't match up exactly with Job's. As poetry, I mean, this is intended to provoke us and make us imagine and reimagine as we find ourselves in this story, and we will. Now, last week, Ed Travers was here, did a great job kind of overviewing what the book of Job is about. And you go right from the beginning, Job is a pretty good guy. He is a pretty good guy. Job chapter 1 starts this way. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. On top of that, we would say Job is living the hashtag blessed life. Okay, he's healthy, he is wealthy, kids, booming business, everything that he could want. If there's a stereotype for the good life, Job's living it. His kids played travel ball and they went to private school, okay? And they were good. They were good, probably. But here's the critical part of the book. Here's the turning point that we cannot miss. And if we do miss this, then I think that we run the risk of like this book actually not making much sense to us at all. Critical point in the book, Satan approaches God and essentially accuses God of having a flawed way of operating in the world. Look carefully at verse 10. Verse 10, this is Satan talking to God. If you have questions about that interaction, post it in the notes app and we'll talk about it. It says this, Satan says, "Have you not put a hedge around Job and his house and all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, or take it away, and he will curse you to your face." In other words, Satan comes to God and says, "God, you know that Job is only interested in you for the benefits, right? Like, obviously, if you bless those who bless you, then people are going to bless you so that you bless them. God, you have to see that, right? People don't really love you. They love what you can do for them. And he's trying to point out that if God operates this way, he actually introduces kind of a pretty big problem in God's plan, right? Because if God is, let's say, fair, then anyone who claims to follow and obey him might actually have some ulterior motives for their obedience. Let me show you what I mean. It's like as a parent, if every time my son Malachi were obedient to me, I gave him $5, what would that produce in him? Or what might that produce in him? He may be obedient because he is a good and upstanding son who wants to show honor to his father, right? He might just want $5. I know my son. He would just wants $5. I told my daughter this story and she said, well, I would be extra obedient so that you would give me $10. Right? Doesn't that kind of introduce like this maybe ulterior motive to obey? Right? Maybe they just want the $5. And what's hiding behind this question that Satan has for God is like, what kind of relationship do you have with people anyway? Like, what kind of relationship is that really? Is it really love? How do you know? And we cannot lose sight of this. The central issue in the book of Job really has nothing to do with Job. It all has to do with God. God is the one who is on trial in the book of Job. And Satan, as the accuser, takes direct aim at the way that he operates in the world, which actually makes a lot of sense when you remember that Job is wisdom literature, right? Because remember, wisdom literature is talking about how God operates in the world, how we function under his rule and reign in this world. And so in response to this accusation in the story, God organizes a set of circumstances in which Job loses everything, all of the blessings, the good gifts from God, everything from his business, his livelihood, his relationships, his health, even his own children, everything he holds dear. Unsurprisingly, he enters into a season of incredible pain. And it'll run the gamut. We'll see from, you know, emotional, physical, relational, spiritual pain. In fact, he gets to such a bad place that when his friends hear about everything that has happened to him, they don't even know what to say, at least not at first. They sit down and shut up for 7 days. Look at the end of chapter 2. And when they saw him from a distance, they did not recognize him. They raised their voices and wept. They tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads towards heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights. And no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. All right. I know that is a ton of context. But I actually think we need all of that to make sense of the first invitation that we're talking about today. Remember, Job is an invitation for us to reimagine God's economy, to reimagine how he operates in the world. And I say economy, not because it has to do with money, but because this is the way that theologians often summarize the multifaceted and interconnected ways that God operates in the world. But okay, so why are we talking about that? Why are we talking about that? And why is the book of Job an invitation to reimagine that? Well, remember, the central issue brought up by Satan in chapter 1 is that there is something inherently broken about the way that God operates. If he will bless those who do good and conceivably punish those who do wrong, right, then he actually introduces an ulterior motive for his people to obey him. They may just want $5. Now, imagine that conversation that I have with my kids again. You obey, you get $5. If you disobey, then I'm going to take your favorite toy outside and break it right in front of you. Okay? That's the flip side of it. What might those two mechanisms produce in the hearts and minds of my own children? Right, in obedience, they may just want the $5 and keep their stuff. This is what Satan is pointing out. And as you move through the book, Job's friends begin to echo the same problem that Satan has pointed out. You think of a courtroom. Satan here is the prosecuting attorney, and Job's friends are all witnesses for the prosecution. They actually end up representing the dominant belief of how God operates. And in a lot of ways, they demonstrate the way that we generally assume that God works in the world. You see, Job's friends believe that the primary attribute of God, we'll see this in a moment, they believe the primary attribute of God, the central controlling aspect that from the very core of who he is, that God is just or fair. And if you read through the book, right, you'll see Job's friends say some iteration of this over and over and over again. This is their only point. Let me give you one example. And I know it's a longer passage, but this represents how all of his friends, including Job himself, believe that God operates. One of them says this in chapter 5. He's explaining to Job, "As for me, I would seek God. And to God would I commit my cause, who does great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number. He gives rain on the earth and sends water on the fields. He sets on high those who are lowly, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. He frustrates the devices of the crafty, so that their hands achieve no success. He catches the wise in their own craftiness. The schemes of the wily are brought to a quick end. They meet with darkness in the daytime and grope at noonday as in the night. But he saves the needy from the sword of their mouth and from the hand of the mighty. So the poor have hope, and injustice shuts her mouth." In other words, they're saying over and over again, God takes care of the righteous and he deals with the unrighteous. Here's how it works. You do good, God gives you good. You do bad, God gives you bad. You obey, he gives you $5. You disobey, he takes everything you have and breaks it. That's the paradigm they're working with. This is how they believe God to work in the world. No exception. He is just. He's fair at the core of who he is. Now, because they believe this, about God, there's actually very little question for any of Job's friends as to why he is experiencing anything that he's got going on. And over again, they begin to explain why all of this stuff has happened to him. They say, "Look, Job, we know two things. Right, we know that God is just, and we know that God is fair. We know that you are suffering. The only conclusion, then, is that you have done something to deserve this." Why? Because that's how God works. You do good, you get good. You do bad, you get bad. Job, you got bad, which means you have done something. You have done something. They say it this way in chapter 4. They say, "Remember, who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? Job, come on, give me one example where this has happened, Job. As I have seen those who plow iniquity, so trouble reap the same." Now, I don't want to spoil the rest of the book, all right? But this kind of response is shockingly very unhelpful to Job. He finds it profoundly unhelpful. But it's not because they're being mean to him or he thinks that they're wrong or way off. Maybe they could have kept, come on guys, keep that opinion to yourself for a little bit, right? But I don't think we can really write off everything that Job's friends say to him as like worldly wisdom, or they just missed the point, or they don't really understand what's going on. In fact, if you flip over just a few pages in the Old Testament to the book of Proverbs, one of the other wisdom books, right, that's supposed to show us how God operates in his world, you're going to find a ton of alignment and an alarming amount of alignment between what Job's friends say and what almost all of the Proverbs talk about. I mean, Proverbs is filled with the general idea that if you live a righteous life, you will be blessed. If you do good, you will get good. And if you do bad, you will get bad. If you obey, $5. If you disobey, I'm going to take all your stuff and break it right in front of you. Now, one of the things we can take from that aside from saying, like, that feels, is that a contradiction? Like, what do we do with that? I think one of the things we can take is that sometimes, you can draw a very straight line between your actions and consequences. Like, if I'm a jerk and I chase away all the meaningful friendships in my life and then am lonely because of it, right? That loneliness and suffering is real, but it's kind of my fault, right? Like, I'm reaping what I sow in that. See, the problem Job's friends have is that this is the only way that they can make sense of suffering and apply some meaning to it. This is the only way that works in their minds, right? Because God is so just, he will always give you what you deserve. Therefore, Job, if you're suffering, you must deserve this somehow, right? And it's the most natural conclusion to come to in the world. Like, I'm not faulting them for this. The issue, see, is that they have such a high view of God's justice that they are forced into a very specific conclusion that God will only ever give you what you deserve. But frankly, that works fine when life is fine. You might even walk away thinking, like, yeah, I do deserve this when life is good. Take a nice look at your life, the job, the house, the family. Things are moving along just fine. Thank you very much. But you see, when God, in our heart of hearts, when we believe him at the very core, the center of who he is, the controlling aspect of him to be justice or fairness, like Job's friends, what else can we conclude in suffering other than somehow we deserve it? That's a question I've encountered with so many folks over the years of pastoring, like, is they go through very hard seasons of death, losing a loved one, losing relationships where their whole lives have been upturned. The most natural question is, like, what have I done to deserve this? When you think about it like Job's friends, what else can we conclude when your spouse is no longer there? What else can you conclude when you're diagnosed again with a treatment path that is very bleak? What happens when you are, again, spiritually, relationally stuck? You feel like you're bringing your family and friends back into that dark hole with you again. Maybe I deserve this. More than that, I think we have to ask the question, what does it actually do to our souls and how we make sense of God when the primary thing motivating our relationship with him is actually just a desire to get the $5 or not get whacked? And see, I think it's worth asking, even if we've never really said it out loud before, is this actually how I view God? Is this how I view my relationship with him? I mean, honestly, essentially scared of what happens if I step out of line. This dominates our imagination about God far more than we might think. And then you have to ask, like, okay, if I believe that, how might that belief play out in my heart and mind, not just over like a bad day or a bad week, but what might be the sum total effect of years and years and years of really being worried about what's going to happen if you don't always do the right thing or trying to prevent the wrong thing from happening to you? Friends, there are a lot of words that we could use to describe that kind of relationship, but I do not think love is one of the words we could use. What follows in the book of Job is this long and honestly painful back and forth between Job and his friends as they insist time and time and time again that he must have done something. One of them even says, look, Job, maybe you haven't done something yet, but God probably knows you will do something in the future. Maybe that's part of the problem. And you can see Job as he is desperately reaching for answers. Eventually, he stumbles upon the idea that, hey, I just need to present my case before this just God, because if I can show him that I actually have done nothing wrong, then he will vindicate me. I just need to get my case before him. And so he says it this way, Job 23. He says, oh, that I knew where I could find him, that I might even come to his seat. Like, if I could just go to his office. If I could just pop in, he says, I would lay my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I got the receipts, God. You can read along with him as he doesn't want to come out and say God is unjust. He doesn't want to say that God is unfair, but he is circling around this very idea that there is something off. There's something wrong. I know God is just. I know that I'm suffering, but I don't think I've done anything to deserve this. And so he's pleading, God, just tell me why. And then, 38 chapters into the book, God responds. And it's not at all what we would expect. See, like all along the way, like if you're reading through this book, it's building to this moment where Job's friends would if God responds, they're finally going to find out what he did to show that they were right. They're finally going to find out what Job did. The book seems like it's building there. Job's going to find out why God has seemingly violated his core principle of justice and fairness, Job chapter 38. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress like a man for action. I will question you, and you will make it known to me. And God begins to walk through all of creation. Verse 4, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely, Job, you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? Or what were its bases sunk? Who laid its cornerstone? And it goes on like that for two chapters. I mean, there's one way to read this, right? One way to read it that is basically one long, how dare you, Job. Who do you think you are? Which I think is the normal way we read this book. But that would be a really strange response from God, wouldn't it? Like, given everything else we know about his character from the rest of Scripture, like not only does this response not answer any of Job's questions, the completely legitimate questions that he's asking. I mean, It also would sound just kind of cruel, right? Like for him to respond to Job's deep, painful, I mean, Job has a crisis of faith happening right here with all of these deep questions, and God responds with, don't you know I made the hippos and the crocodiles? Like, it doesn't fit the picture, what the rest of the Bible clearly puts forward to us, that God is like a father who cares for his children. Like Psalm 145 says, he's gracious and merciful, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love. The Lord is good to all, and his mercy is over all that he has made. Like, how does this fit with the picture of God's response to Job? And I'll never forget the day that Courtney and I told our kids that we were moving to Columbus. And it had been, you know, just a really challenging season for us personally, relationally, spiritually. And we sat them down on the bed. And I know I've shared a little bit of this before, but we told them we were moving. Malachi, my son's first response was, yay, new friends. And at the same moment in time, my daughter burst into tears. And I remember the follow-up conversation with her. She's sitting there on the bed, her head in her hands. I mean, she's like weeping. Because of what this move was going to mean for her. Like, she's old enough to recognize, like, I have a lot of meaningful friendships here. Like, my life is here. My grandparents are here. Like, everything I know is here. What do you mean we're moving? It's completely legitimate. And as her dad, I suppose I had the option to stand up and say, don't you know that this is my house and my rules and your job is to just go along with the things that mommy and daddy are doing? Don't you know that? At the same time, I also couldn't just sit down and explain to her all of the interconnected, immensely complicated and multifaceted reasons for the move that we were experiencing that would make any sense of this, any sense to her at all. So I'm caught in this split. Like, what do I say to my daughter? She needed the place to be upset. She needed that space. And eventually, even if she didn't want it, she needed to be reminded, a gentle reminder, that she is loved by one who is, who can and ultimately will take care of her. You see, in the same way, I do not think that Job chapter 38, 39, and 40, I don't think this is God saying, Job, you better check yourself before you wreck yourself. No, I think this is God gently but clearly saying, Job, there are things in this world that you do not know. There are things in this world that you cannot see. More importantly, what's happened, you see, is that God has actually invited Job to fundamentally reimagine how he believes God operates in the world. Right, that actually, while Job and his friends and most of them, us most of the time, like we believe God at his core is fair and just, and he is fair and just. Right, but through the book of Job, God invites us to reimagine him as one who is more than fair. He's wise. Right, that he is one who is far bigger and far greater than anything we could see. And in his wisdom, he is powerful and good and kind. He is gracious and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. And ironically, it's the rest of the biblical storyline that unfolds that we find God, who is one who is scandalously unfair, who graciously and lovingly gives what we have not earned, what we have not deserved. Because if we were to get what is coming to us, if that's the only way God ever works, the scriptures are very clear that in our brokenness, in our failure to live the way that we have been created to live, if there's anything we have earned, it is judgment. But you see, God, in the whole story of the gospel, in his wonderful unfairness, has made a way for us to be healed, to be made well, a way for us to be restored to him when we should have been rejected, when we should have been left on our own, having walked away. You see, the book of Job points forward to another one who was blameless and upright and still treated unfairly. But that in the person and work of Jesus, we see God's plan ultimately to redeem and heal come to its full fruition, that in his divine unfairness put on full display in the gospel, we see Jesus who lived the way we should have lived, but lovingly, willingly says to God the Father, hey, give me not what I deserve, give me what they deserve. And what the scriptures talk about as this great exchange, we read this in 2 Corinthians, for our sake, he made him, Jesus, to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God, that all of our brokenness, the shame, the weight of our sin transferred to Jesus and his righteousness transferred over to us. Friends, do you see what's happening here in the book of Job? We have been invited to rethink and reimagine God's economy, how he works in the world, how he works with us. He is not just the you simply get what you deserve God. No, you see, in the gospel, when we put our faith in Jesus, we find one who is a you get what he deserves God. In a scandalous, unfairness. We find one who is gracious and merciful. So what now? The right question is, Dan, how does reimagining God's economy help me at all? The bad news is that in the short run, it probably doesn't. It probably doesn't. Some of you are here today and are in deep, deep, long season of pain and frustration. But the thing that you don't need is some disgruntled millennial telling you that, hey, God is far bigger than you could possibly imagine. But that's probably unhelpful in the short run. But I will say that what the book of Job offers us in the long run is infinitely more valuable than any silver bullet verse we could try and slap onto our suffering. See, it's an invitation ultimately to pause and say, perhaps God is not just giving me what I deserve. Perhaps as I reimagine what he is like, to find one who is wonderfully, scandalously unfair, one who is unfathomably wise, we slowly, over time, in following Jesus, become the kinds of people who begin to lay out our lives in front of him and say, God, Father, I choose to believe that there may be things I do not see. There may be things I do not understand. Friends, we are invited to reimagine God, how he works and what he's like as one who is loving, good, and from the core of his being, a wise father. See, when I was talking to my daughter Evelyn, what she didn't need is really an answer as to why we were doing this. What she needed in that moment was to be able to trust her mom and dad. And in the same way as we go through deep seasons of pain, the thing we want more than anything else is often an answer. But what we need is to trust our wise and loving Father. Now, how do you take a hold of this invitation? Like, practically, what do you do? This is the challenging thing about wisdom literature. Wisdom is often not action-oriented. It's much more reflection-oriented. So I'm going to challenge you with something as we go through this book. Because again, I'm not trying to give you just a silver bullet series that you can apply to your life later on when you hit a dark season of life. No, I'm giving us something that we can hold on to as we meander through the rest of our lives. I'm going to challenge you with something this week. I'm going to challenge you to read the book of Job. And actually, I'm going to challenge you to do it in one sitting. I did the math. According to how long it takes the average adult reader, it should take you about 60 minutes to read through the book of Job. That's two episodes of The Office. Gotcha. We got time. I challenge you to read through the entire book of Job. And what you will find is more and more an invitation to take hold and reimagine how God works in this world. Second thing we're going to do is we're going to remember what we do. Part of what we do as we gather as a church family is we reflect and celebrate the scandalous unfairness that God has shown us in the gospel. And we do this by taking the Lord's Supper together, by taking communion. It is the practice of remembering that God has given us in Jesus what we have not earned, what we have not deserved. And so we're going to do this a little bit differently today. I'm going to give you an opportunity as we begin to sing this song. I want you to use this time actually as a moment of reflection, a moment where you may need to say, God, I am angry with you because I do not understand. I am frustrated in my own brokenness. I feel like I have wandered off. Whatever you need to say to God, this is an opportunity for us to pause and confess back to God what he already knows to be true of us. And in this moment, we are remembering ultimately his wonderful, scandalous unfairness in Jesus giving his life for ours, that in his death and resurrection, we would find forgiveness, healing, and new life. So I'm gonna invite you to take a couple moments of reflection for this. We will come up and we will take the Lord's Supper together.